Hello, and welcome once again to Big Mouth, the pop culture talk show for the thinking layabout. On Big Mouth, we take a good look at what's really happening in the worlds of music, film, books, and TV. My name's Andrew Harrison, and here to help us work out what it all means are our two special guests. Dorian Linsky is one of the Guardian star music writers with a work rate that is positively Stakhanovite. Amongst his big pieces this year are a look at Baz Luhrmann's hip-hop drama, The Get Down, interviews with James Blake and Phil Collins, and a heartbreaking investigation into the life and sad death of Bristolian reggae legend DJ Derek. Dorian also writes for Q and GQ, and he's the author of the brilliant history of protest music, 33 and a third revolutions per minute. Hello, Dorian. How are you today?
I'm all right, Andrew.
Jolly good. Yeah,
thanks. That's very nice. That's blushing.
Close to the mic. I'm all right, Andrew. Thank you very much. So I said on Facebook yesterday, you've recently spotted that hip-hop has basically realised that it's been using Donald Trump as the epitome of success and high-rolling for about 25 years, and now it feels terrible about it. It feels guilty. Has hip-hop accidentally created Donald Trump, do you think?
Well, it's entirely logical that he's the rapper's idea of a rich guy. He's just very sort of self-aggrandizing, single-minded, likes gold and bragging. Yeah. And so it was always like, you're going to mention him rather than Bill Gates. You don't want to be like rolling like Bill Gates, because Bill Gates doesn't roll. So you want to be like Trump. And then suddenly it's like, oh, by the way, I'm a quasi-fascist racist.
Yes.
And they've got these songs in their back catalogue called like Up With Trump.
Yeah.
Whatever. And now they're desperately embarrassed about it and have to kind of like either sort of not perform them or sort of dismantle them while they're performing them to go, right, we not that Trump, not this Trump, but like the fun Trump.
The fun Trump.
Old school Trump.
I think you were also saying that like Trump is basically like the mediocre rapper, because he yells on about his own products and he just loves covering everything in gold. And he's got a string of videogenic women behind him.
And there was an interview, I think, with the New York Times where he was watching himself on TV while being interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
And
eating Kentucky Fried Chicken.
What?
He eats Kentucky Fried Chicken
and
during
interviews.
And I thought
this was very much like interviewing Exhibit on his tour bus, where he watched TV while I was interviewing him and was eating.
But
and I thought,
really
he's kind of like a rapper. But then I started thinking, what rapper is he like? And actually, everyone I could think of was sort of cleverer, more nuanced, more complicated than Trump. That there is no rapper as kind of as shallow and void as Trump.
So what you're saying essentially is America should elect Lil Jon as president rather than Trump.
That'd be great.
Or, you know,
T-Pain.
Yeah, or literally anybody.
Literally anybody, yeah.
Is there not a case? There must be a case somewhere of Trump actually in his kind of mid-90s pomp appearing on rap. Did no rapper ever get him on a record?
Trump has no interest. When I was writing about this, I realised that Trump has, because he has no interest in culture, in music, the only connection I could find was when he was at the launch party of Studio 54, weirdly, when he was 30, when he was an up-and-coming wanker, a full-blown wanker. And then, he did respond to one of the records about him, you know, which is just going, I'm rolling like Trump or whatever. And then a year later threatened to sue the rapper for using his name without permission, which you can't do, obviously, but just showed you just what a toxic waste dump of a man he is, that he would actually just think, this is a good thing to do.
Excellent. Also with us, raising the tone for away from Donald Trump, is Esquire magazine's deputy editor Johnny Davis. Johnny's a veteran of the Face magazine. He's now in the world of fine watches and men's style and nice socks. Most recently, he interviewed Simon Pegg, the most influential Brit in Hollywood, for Esquire. Hello, Johnny. How are you today?
Hello, Andrew. I'm very well. Thank you for having me.
So how was Simon Pegg?
He's lovely. But you know, the weird thing with him was that sometimes people say, what are you up to? Who are you interviewing and stuff? Everybody, when I mentioned Simon Pegg, they would often say, oh, I don't like him. Which
really?
That's a strange thing. That doesn't often happen. And I think it's perhaps a sort of British dislike of success. He's great. His enormous success that he has in America in these franchises. So
he used to be really likable. That used to be his thing.
Yeah.
He was just like your mate who had done well. But maybe you don't want your mate to do too well.
I wonder what point it goes over from, like, it goes Spaced, Shaun of the Dead. What point the kind of...
I think being with Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible,
over.
I think that's probably too much for people. But that was a weird thing. But he was sort of famously extremely nice and charming, gave me lots of time.
Well, he's a 2000 AD guy, and he used to do the voices for the Strontium Dog audiobook, so I will always like him for that.
Yes, his character in Space, Bisley, Simon Bisley, because of the artist.
Because of 2000 AD. Also with us, as ever, is the dependable C-3PO to my incompetent R2-D2, ensuring that we sound beautiful at all times. It's Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How are you doing?
My voice can't do that.
You're C-3PO. You get to talk in the nice voice.
Oh, that's true. In any audit of Kenny Baker's obits, nobody said, and I don't know if it's if it's true or not, my favourite line of any kind of actorly tiff is Anthony Daniels, who plays 3PCO, apparently once said when they were both getting costumed up, his makeup person came towards him with the kind of C-3PO mask.
Mm.
And he said, no, the face doesn't go on until the dwarf goes in the tin.
There was a lovely cartoon in the New Yorker of Luke Skywalker and C-3PO with the R2-D2 robot, and the caption was just said, he feels empty inside.
Oh.
Which is like a real heartbreaker if you're an aging nerd like me. Anyway, let's get on with the podcast proper. On his holidays this week, like everybody else, and apparently D-Mob happy, is President Barack Obama, who marked his final summer in the White House by releasing not one, but two Spotify playlists, one for daytime and one for nighttime. How does the most powerful man in the free world have time to sit around making playlists on Spotify? We'll be discussing that in a minute. But first, here is a song from Obama's nighttime playlist from 1971. This is Denise LaSalle and the brilliant Trapped by a Thing Called Love. Go, are you feeling smoothed? From DJ Barack Obama's summer playlist, that was Trapped by a Thing Called Love by Denise LaSalle. He's released two summer playlists and his reading list. Let's talk about the playlists first. Dorian, there's absolutely no triangulation or pandering to the broad audience here on Obama's playlists, are they? This is black American music, unadorned and unapologetic. What did you reckon to it?
Oh, well, I mean, I loved it. I like his taste.
Yes.
And he really, it's genuine.
Yeah.
And I feel like if you think back to when Clinton came in, there was this excitement that there was any kind of, there was a president with any kind of grasp of pop culture. It was fairly straight down the road.
Yeah.
You know, he like, you know, Don't Stop by Fleetwood Mac was his legend theme.
Kind of a Blues Brothers kind of guy.
Yeah. Very, that was it. Like saxophone with like sunglasses on.
He was posited as America's first black president, wasn't he?
Yeah. Mm. A very long time ago, Matt.
That quote hasn't lasted that long. But yeah, he was kind of, but it was the fact that he was anyone, you know, that there was a president who had any understanding of popular culture.
Yeah.
And Barack Obama has a particularly sort of keen understanding. He's got a very particular areas of taste. It was very exciting, you know, the fact that his first date with Michelle was going to see Do the Right Thing.
Mm.
And you just think that's brilliant.
Yeah.
And there's nothing sort of faked about it. It's not, I mean, I know the Gordon Brown Arctic Monkeys thing, he was kind of lured into that a little bit. But of course Gordon Brown doesn't give a shit, plainly.
I don't think Gordon Brown listens to music at all, does he?
There's this sort of question, I suppose going back to what we were saying about Trump, is that Dennis Healy quote about people that have a hinterland. And it's quite rare. There's a lot of politicians that don't appear to have any great cultural interests. People get very excited, you know, when Stella Creasy's like into indie or something.
Mm.
But with Obama, it's kind of quite deep. And it's, you know, there's a few deep cuts on here. It's not like the best of Motown or whatever.
It's not a hipster's playlist, isn't it? It's not someone's not helped him do it.
No, exactly.
Totally genuine.
Yeah. So
and you think that things like Courtney Barnett on there are actually kind of proof of that he's done it himself rather than somebody else going, actually, we need to have
no
some
doubt
kind of...
that he's just sat there one night in the White House, thought, da 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 da, select these tracks, press send. I don't think anyone, it seems.
Well, he doesn't need to do any messaging now. That's the thing. I think maybe I wonder if you went back and looked at the ones that he was being, when he was asked in 2008, where maybe he chose a song and he goes, well, this represents the gospel tradition. This is a hip-hop record, but one that won't scare the horses. You know, you have to think like that. But this whole thing of the last year of a presidency, where you're just like, he's sort of like, you're going to miss me when I'm gone.
Yes,
you should have put
that
awesome.
On. That would have been great.
I know, that would have been really good. It's a little pointed.
Do you know the coolest thing about it is? He name checks himself in it, in the Damien Lewis and Nas one. There's the rhyme, like true Obamas unfold the drama. I mean, well, amazing.
Yeah, I mean, the tracks on the night playlist, are Aaron Neville, D'Angelo, Miles Davis, Tower of Power, Kitano Veloso, Method Man and Mary J. Blige are on it. It's his kind of Mike Yelwood, This Is Me moments, isn't it? It's like, you know, there's one or two little bits in there on both of the playlists that are kind of nods to the kind of NPR, Portlandia, latte-drinking, middle-class, sort of white Obama voter. You know, there's a bit of Fiona Apple there.
Yep.
And there's Edwin Sharp and the Magnetic Zeros. I can't imagine, you know, them playing that in the White House. But mostly it's like, this is the stuff I actually like. And it just seems astonishing that we can find it so strange that a politician can just be honest.
Yeah. But also it's great. If you check the White House Spotify account, they've also got Joe Biden to do his playlist.
Yes.
Is it all like Jimmy Buffett?
It's Bruce Springsteen. It's The Beatles Come Together. It's Adele Hello. There's a bit of Lady Gaga. There's Al Green, Sinatra, Frankie Valli, Tina Turner, simply the best.
And Joe obviously.
Cocker, You Are So Beautiful.
Biden he's just like a good time guy, isn't he?
I think The Onion have been doing to him the last 8 years is actually
he's like the guy in a Hawaiian shirt, he's brought some brewskis, and he's just like, let's put on the boss and have a good time. So it's sincere in his own way as well. Yeah.
Do we think also that maybe, Dorian, you just said Obama doesn't need to do any messaging now, but do you think there might be just a little slight middle finger to the section of the electorate that's just still really pissed off that there's a black guy in the White House? Do you think there might be a little bit of presidential playlist trolling going on
here? Culturally, I think he was always quite frank about that. He was like, this is my music. These are my tastes. This is genuinely his music taste. And I don't think he ever kind of hid that fact. It's just, I don't think it's ever been quite as good as this. It's sort of like a really smart mixtape from a friend where there's hits you recognize and there's stuff that I've never heard before.
It's gone to number one, hasn't it, on the Spotify World Playlist, whatever, both of them have. And the guy, there's some quote from the guy in charge of Spotify, whatever, saying if he, you know, in his next job, if he wants to curate music for us, you know, we'll bang up for it, because it's really good.
I'm really waiting for the Russian version to come back with Putin's playlist. I'd be looking forward to that.
I killed a bear. Track two, I killed another bear. What I like about the White House Spotify account is its name is The White House, all one word, all lowercase, you know, like The Weeknd or something. Or just like, they're properly, they really, really thought about this, you know.
Right.
And I can just imagine Sean Hannity seeing this and steam coming out of his ears in fury that they could be so connected, you know.
Well, I think this reminds me of the fact that it's almost, you can assess Obama as a president based on various policies and legislative achievements, and you can go really deep, you know, which I do as a sort of politics geek, into, you know, his strengths and weaknesses as a political operator. But in this final phase, as we're in the middle of another election campaign with one of, you know, the most terrific candidate there has ever been in Trump, is that just as a person, as kind of an identifiable person in this position of power, he does have a kind of special appeal, which, you know, and you can still go, well, I disagree with drone strikes, or, well, maybe he, you know, didn't do enough to close Guantanamo Bay or whatever. But it's the fact that he is a sort of recognizable human being with interests, a sense of humor. He really nails things like the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Yeah.
It's like when all those times when you see another politician called upon to just be like a human being and make a joke.
Yeah.
Or choose a song that you actually believe they're into.
Yeah.
And they can't do it because they're like, I'm just too busy doing all this other stuff. Yeah. I don't have room in my brain. And he has plenty of room in his brain to have this kind of expansive sort of inner life.
Yeah. Well, Cameron put together a playlist for the G8 leaders in 2013, and it was supposed to be a romantic playlist. Why he wants romance coming to the G8, I don't know. And the artists were Alt-J, Jake Bugg, Laura Mavula, Tom O'Dell, Connor Maynard, and they probably should have kicked us out of Europe for that.
He's never done that, has he?
No, of course he hasn't.
He's promoting the British record industry.
Why are our politicians so crap at this?
You mentioned Gordon Brown. He asked again about the Arctic Monkeys thing. He revealed that he did have an iPod that his wife bought for him, but it's full of speeches. That's what he had on it.
So. Wow.
I actually prefer that, I think. I don't like the idea of politicians sitting around listening to music.
Exactly, it's not their job. Get on with running the country. Yeah. Don't get on with reading, you know, music magazines.
I was furious when Sherry Blair got pregnant while Blair was Prime Minister. You shouldn't have time. You should not have time for this. You've got a country to run. What the hell?
I know.
You know, we don't want business time in number 10. Get on with it, you know.
It's true.
I tried to see if there was a Donald Trump account on Spotify, and there is a fake one, and the first track one is Kill You by Eminem. So, representing the values there.
You know, he's genuinely come on stage at a convention to It's the End of the World as We Know It, But I Feel Fine. that genuinely happened.
Yes, that is trolling, though, isn't it? That's music trolling.
And when he introduced Mike Pence, who was sort of famously not his first pick for VP, they were playing You Can't Always Get What You Want. And you just think, did you? I don't think he's that
he doesn't
smart
know,
and subtle to be like, kind of, yeah, this is just a subtle passag put down on Mike Pence.
Yeah.
He's just like, he just doesn't care. He has no interest in things that aren't himself,
yeah.
Which is why, like, his favourite books, the only books he ever mentions are the Bible and The Art of the Deal.
Yes, which he didn't write.
Which he didn't write.
Yes.
Films, what films does he like? No idea. What music does he like? No idea.
Yeah.
And there is something about that that it's sort of very scary if you have somebody who neither has the interest in policy nor the interest in anything else.
Yes.
You know, he's neither Barack Obama or Gordon Brown. He's just interested in one thing.
Yes.
Which is himself. And that is sort of terrifying.
It is terrifying.
The new Private Eye, as an aside, has one of the Are They Possibly Related letters is Donald Trump and Kenny Everett with his massive hands saying, let's bomb Russia. And it works brilliantly.
Let's move on then to from Obama's playlist to a completely different way of listening to music. This week I've become pretty much addicted to a new French streaming music service called radio.com, and it's got up to, well, five or more O's on the end of it, so I don't know how you pronounce it. It's a fantastically brilliant idea. You choose a country, you choose a decade from the past 100 years, and you choose slow, fast or weird. And radio then plays you amazing and truly rare selections uploaded by crate diggers around the world. Here's a montage of some of the things that we heard.
Christmas Eve morning, baby, I was on my way back home to you. Christmas Eve morning, baby, I was on my way back home to you. It was your love that kept me fighting, kept me safe the whole war through.
Some selections there from the random world of radio.com with five O's. We pressed the weird button and we heard music from Russia, Mexico, Egypt, the United States, Ethiopia. Basically, we are Damon Albarn. I'm afraid we're going to have to use the C word here, aren't we? Curation. Johnny Davis, did you have a go on radio? What do you think of this?
I did. I enjoyed it and it kept me there for quite a while, sort of fussing about through the decades and the countries and stuff. It looks very nice. It's a nicely designed kind of hand-drawn map of the world. And you can kind of invite you to kind of dig into the atlas and pick different countries. it's fun. Ultimately, I wonder if I'll, you know, given that there's SoundCloud and Spotify and Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, yeah, do I need another digital platform in my life?
Yeah.
Maybe not, but it's, yeah, it's a cool thing.
I just wonder whether, because I don't know about you, but I certainly suffer from option paralysis. The minute I open up Spotify, I think, great, the universe of music. What should I listen to? And right, the tumbleweed and the Tweety Birds.
Yeah, Pettibone.
I'll listen to the Pet Shop Boys. Yes, maybe I'll listen to British Sea Power again. And I think the nice thing about this is it kind of takes the choice out. It's freedom from choice.
That's true.
It's weird. It's like a nice mix of programmed radio and you having your own choice.
But you can do that with any number of radio stations, the way you put in one song and they and endlessly kind of curate stuff for you. So,
yeah.
For me, it was like, it's nice, but I didn't feel it was essential.
But I suppose the nice thing, when you turn on a radio station on Spotify, it plays you music that's like the song you've just played.
Right.
And the nice thing about this is it plays you stuff totally left field. It can be anything. It could be dreadful, but it'll always be interesting. Dorian, what did you reckon?
Yeah, I liked it for almost the historical factor. I mean, it's generally good listening, but it's also just a way of getting a feel for a certain country in a certain era. And I remember when I was doing a column which was based on readers' recommendations, and I would end up sort of venturing into more sort of, you know, world music and maybe much sort of older music. And I found like some of those songs incredibly evocative of a certain place and time. So it was almost, the effect was sort of almost cinematic. And when you're in this map and you're just like, oh, what were they playing? And most of it is quite populist music.
Yeah.
So, what would they be playing in a cab in Morocco in the 1950s?
Yeah.
And the ability to hear that and sort of place yourself in there. It's not necessarily like hip. Because when I thought I'm going to try Britain in the 80s and see what they come up with. Mm-hmm. The first song was Wham. Mm-hmm. So then I went for Weird, because you can choose, like, isn't it chilled, upbeat and weird?
Yeah.
And Weird, they had The Police.
Yeah.
Which maybe not the weirdest band in Britain in the 80s.
Yeah.
But then I thought,
are French, by the way. The people who put the thing off, they maybe found The Police
but
really
maybe
weird.
Maybe that's the point. Maybe the whole point is like, oh, what would it be like if I was in Britain in the 80s and I turn on the radio? Yeah, okay. You'd Wham, maybe if they push the boat out, a bit of Police.
Well, I think that's interesting that you say that, because that is actually what they want to do. They've built it as a musical time machine, and it came from the guy who invented it had been driving around in his dad's open-top car on the French Riviera, like I say, very French. And they turn on the radio and some terrible bit of contemporary pop comes out and ruins the moment. So he wanted to find a way of recreating a moment, be it, you know, Russia in 1950 or Jamaica in 1980. I was caning Greece in the 70s with the Weird button turned on, and it turns out that Greece was making a hell of a lot of very fit for purpose breakbeat style weird funk, and you can sort of picture yourself with a very tiny, very strong cup of coffee and a very tiny, very strong fag somewhere, you know,
with a military hunter in the background.
Yeah, and it is incredibly
always ruining the mood with your hunters.
Oh,
I was going to say, talking of hunters, I was going to say Brazil 70s, if you want kind of good times, you don't want to move, just keep clicking Brazil in the 70s, because it's amazing, notwithstanding the hunter. But then it makes you think about all that stuff in a kind of very interesting way. You choose a country that you're not expecting. You choose like Greenland in the 60s, and then it turns out there's this kind of a band called the Eskimos. Wouldn't work.
only one
as a garage rock band, obviously billing themselves as like, well, but you know, if you got it, work it. So they're the Eskimo garage rock band,
number one band in Greenland,
presumably in the 60s.
Yeah,
and so it's not just, what's nice is it's not just the authentic sound of wherever.
Yeah,
there's all this sort of cross pollination. So it is kind of like it's Brazilian funk, or it's Greek prog rock, or it's.
Do you ever think there might be an element of the sort of the John Peel syndrome here, where a lot of us around this table listen to music far, far more than normal people, and there is a point at which you just want to hear something different no matter what, and Peel would play often by his own admission quite bad records just because they sounded different and it would give him a different sensation.
Yes, that's true. It does that for you, for sure.
Okay, well, you can read a little bit more about radio and how it came to be on our WordPress site, which is bigmouth.wordpress.com, and there's all sorts of interesting reading on there. Now let's move on to something completely different. Hip-hop veterans De La Soul are back with their first full album in 12 years, De La Soul and the Anonymous Nobody. Since they released The Grind Date in 2004, they've been edging back into public consciousness via various guest appearances, particularly with Gorillaz on Feel Good Inc. and Plastic Beach. We're going to talk about the album in a minute, but first, here's the track from the album. This is Nosed Up.
In from the doorsteps of dumbass struts to fool's gold. Know it all, and you wear well. Funkless and fooling.
Nosed Up from the album De La Soul and the Anonymous Nobody. Dorian Lynskey, what do you make of this? Can we officially call it a comeback?
Yes, and it's a very smart comeback. It's a self-aware one because, I mean, getting older, sustaining a career in hip-hop is really hard. Mm. Normally, you either keep doing the thing that you did and become... your records become increasingly irrelevant. Or you try and get on everyone's record. Busta Rhymes is still...
Yes.
And he's still doing sort of good verses, but he's still trying to be like... appearing over like a Diplo beat,
yeah.
Or doing a guest verse with Chris Brown or whatever, and that doesn't seem sort of endlessly sustainable. And I think what De La Soul realized post Gorillaz, the kind of live shows, the kind of audience they have now, which let's face it, is probably older.
Yes,
and they're just like, okay, we're gonna go in that Gorillaz-y direction. We're gonna be sort of unashamedly indie minded about it, and that's exactly what they should be doing, that rather than trying to be like, but how can we make the young hip-hop kids care?
Yeah.
They're like, no, fine, we'll get Little Dragon and David Byrne and Justin Hawkins for 7 minutes. Well, maybe that wasn't their best idea. but it seems like, that's... And Damon Albarn, and it's like, that's exactly... If I was De La Soul's A&R man or consigliere, I would say, do a record like that.
But actually, they have got 2 Chainz guesting on a track.
True.
Who actually does, I think, kind of the most coherent verse that I've ever heard him deliver. And they've got Rock Marciano for the kind of underground heads as well. So they have... covered bases,
but it's in that eclectic Gorillaz-y way where you would get you would get rappers on as well as sort of indie people. They're not trying to be something they're not. They're realizing what people liked about them was this sort of benign. I mean, obviously they're kicked against this sort of benign, sappy Daisy Age image, but there's still, people feel very sort of warmly towards them.
Mm.
And this seems to be an album that's sort of very well aimed at people who would still be interested in De La Soul in 2000.
Yeah, Johnny, this record has definitely got, it's got a capital C concept. It is about the state of music as it's been, as its role has changed because of the incident streaming and digital and piracy.
Yes.
And also there's this very sad background about the fact that the rights for their back catalogue are so tangled that you literally can't get 3 Feet High and Rising, one of the greatest rap albums ever made. You can't get it anymore. This is like not being able to hear Ziggy Stardust, isn't it? It's like not being able to hear.
A little bit, although I have to say, the reason they can't, you can't get 3 Feet High and Rising on streaming or anywhere, it's because they can't clear all the samples for it.
Yeah.
Nobody at the record company thinks it's a good enough use of their time to put the effort into doing that. And in a way, I'm kind of with them. It's like, if you're the record company, it's like, what they need to do, they crowdfunded this record, right?
Yeah.
Which I think is a kind of it seems mind-blowing that somebody as famous as De La Soul needs to ask, go cap in hand to people and say, give us some money to make a record. They should crowdfund somebody to go and clear the samples then.
That's actually a really good idea.
They did get like 6 times the amount they needed.
Yeah, so but it's also, I just think it's a bit sad. It's like, if you gave them some money if you gave them $7,500, you could guest rap on it, or you could appear in the video or something like this. I mean,
I know people who would pay to clear the samples on the De La Soul.
it's a good job, right? Yeah, I think it's a bit tragic things have got to that state where they have to do a little video saying, give us some money and we'll make a rap.
But you know what, though? I kind of respect that, because that is... That is the hustle. You cannot knock the hustle. And what they're not doing is going, you know what, sod this. I'm going to just like pack it in and vanish into obscurity.
Right.
They want to continue making music. To me, I think this is a fantastic record. They have found a way to be grown-up middle-aged rappers. There's bits of funk and funkadelic in here. There's lots of it sounds kind of slightly Gorillaz-y, where it mixes that European synth.
But also, De La Soul probably have that kind of self-awareness, and maybe they have people like a consigliere, as Dorian was saying, in their kind of team who can say, that's getting a bit self-indulgent, or obviously he'd gone out for coffees when the Justin Hawkins track was being recorded.
Which I like, by the way.
But imagine the danger of just giving most rappers $500,000 and going, make a record and nobody's going to tell you that anything's wrong on it. You can just do what you
want.
Right. In fairness, isn't that the business model of the record industry at the moment? It's $500,000, do what you like. We'll put it out, skits and all.
Yeah, but it's a great advertisement for, creative freedom and trusting people, and it's not self-indulgent. You know, that if this was on a major label, you know, they probably wouldn't change much. They'd go, this is great, you know.
If it was on a major label, they probably would have been hustled to get slightly more mainstream guest artists, I would have thought. I think what you just mentioned in how they got Justin Hawkins, and there's a bit of a pecking order there. They went looking for Axl Rose, and they couldn't get Axl Rose.
Lenny Kravitz.
Then, yeah, went looking for anything. But I think it's absolutely fine and spot on that they should get these very idiosyncratic, unusual people.
Like everyone's been saying, it is very like Plastic Beach Girls, even down to, you know, obviously Damon Albarn's on it, obviously Little Dragon's on it.
That's kind of the law, though, isn't it? Damon Albarn has to be on everything. It's not allowed otherwise, yeah.
But I think that this sort of thing about the streaming and how, okay, you can't get it on Spotify, you know, that when we were younger, it was just kind of the norm that you couldn't get people who are now just sort of canonical artists. It's just like, oh no, you can't buy you know, Nick Drake on CD, or you can't buy you know, the Velvet Underground. You literally, you'd have these moments where an album, an artist would be reissued, and then suddenly you'd hear bands being influenced by them, literally, because it was like the first time that they could get hold of this record. So it's an old thing that there would be periods where you just couldn't hear a certain artist. It's just now we expect we should be able to. And I think one of the most unappreciated areas is sort of late 80s, early 90s hip-hop on the layer below people like De La Soul. And I've always wanted there to be a Nuggets sort of box set where you had people like Main Source or Black Moon or people that might not be on streaming services or people that had this sort of, you know, one brilliant album or even just one brilliant song. Because I feel like so much of this stuff should be as well known as Three Feet High and Rising, and just isn't.
It's not a new. There's loads of house records you can't get on anything.
Right,
but you can get them on YouTube and play them. And that, for me, that's fine. You can get Three Feet High and Rising on Amazon. I mean, it's on vinyl. It's £40, but if you want it,
might sell mine.
It's, do you know what I mean? It's not impossible to find Three Feet High and Rising if you want it. It's just not there at the press of a button, and that's a good thing. I encourage you to, you know.
I think the record that Dorian just described is actually called Matt Hall Presents Hip Hop.
I was just thinking, what a great job that would be compiling.
Oh, hip hop in my loft in Nottingham.
As long as you can have the Bush Babies on it, that'd be great.
I can vividly remember going into Jumbo Records in Leeds and walking through the door and the guy behind the counter holding up a copy of 3 Feet High and Rising and going, you need this, buy it now. And I hadn't even heard of it before. But that was kind of like, that was an amazing revelatory thing for me. But I like the idea that it's now a rare record again.
Yeah.
That for some people out there, a lot younger than us, discovering this is going to be a moment rather than just another thing that pops up on somebody's playlist of 5,000 essential records you must hear before you die.
Yeah.
I think it's just an attractive thing.
Yeah, and hopefully this record will help, you know, advertise that fact.
Yeah. The record itself, I've got to admit, I've not been paying close attention to them for the past 10 years. They did another album between the grind date in 2004, which was just two of them, I think. I was really impressed by this. It's a record. I would listen again. I would listen a lot. What do you think? Are we going to be returning to it?
Well, definitely. But they've always been kind of, you know, consistent. They've, you know, their most famous record, obviously, is the debut. But De La Soul is Dead, I think, is better. I think Balloon Mind State is better. And then they just kept doing good records. They never really, and even maybe some of the patchy records, have these astonishing songs. They did one which had a track with CeeLo before he became sort of proper pop star, called Held Down, which was an incredible song. Like, they never just did duds in the way that some rappers, some are in whatever genre, you know.
Yeah.
There are periods of their career where you're just like, forget it, you're missing nothing. And De La Soul always managed to keep a certain level of quality up, even if they weren't punching through commercially. And I feel like because of the story behind this, because of the long gap, because of the guests, everything just seems kind of designed that this record might actually get its due.
Yeah.
And not just be, you know, another De La Soul record that gets slept on, as they say.
Yeah. So basically what we're saying is, to eBay right now, everyone.
What, sell or buy?
Buy. Well, you've probably got crates of it to sell and fund your obscure hip-hop habit. Okay, right, that's enough senior hip-hop for one day. Let's move to the other end of the musical spectrum. On the 26th of August, a very different music documentary opens in cinemas across Britain. Android in La La Land follows Gary Newman and his family as they move from the UK to Los Angeles and attempt to restart his career. What starts out as a fly-on-the-wall documentary becomes something a bit deeper as we start to explore Gary Newman's Asperger's syndrome, his depression, and the things that finally sort him out and save him. We're going to be talking about the film in a minute, but first, here is Gary Newman from 1979. This is Cars.
Cars.
Gary Numan with Cars. Any Numanoids around the table?
The thing with this film is it makes a very big deal at the start of him being this kind of great force in music.
Yeah.
And for the last 30 years, he's been innovating, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And actually, at no point in the film do you ever... You get Cars and you get Our Friends Electric. And you don't get that. He's made 20 albums or 19 albums or something.
Yeah.
I've no idea what any of them sound like.
I think the film slightly oversells the influential nature of Gary Numan. Because, I mean, to me, he's kind of influential in a narrow niche. You know, if you're really into your industrial pipe-banging, clanging stuff, Gary Newman's a big deal.
Right.
If you're not, he's kind of a thing that's happening over there. But what do you think of the film? What do you think of it as a...
I mean, from the premise at the start, you think this is, you know, Gary Newman, really? Does he deserve a documentary? Has he really been this influential the last 30 years? And then, as you alluded to, it's not really about his music career. It's about his family. He has this amazing... Well, she was a fan initially. He married his fan, Gemma, who just kind of sorts him out and guides him through as a hapless character with, as you say, Asperger's, genuine stage fright, money problems, totally shy, trying to get a career back on the road that's basically based on these two songs from nearly 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And his kids are amazing. He moves to LA, which seems to suit him better because he's sort of playing in these tiny rock clubs with a kind of tattooed up younger kind of band with him. And it's kind of endearing. I mean, it's a nice, enjoyable watch, whatever you think of, you know, whatever your opinion of Gary Newman is. It's certainly worth seeing.
I was totally won over by him, totally charmed by him. I'd interviewed him very, very briefly years ago and been surprised at how I mean, you don't expect people to be their stage persona, but he had a very, very dry sense of...
He wasn't a robot.
Hello, Andrew. He had a very, very dry
sense of... wasn't in a car.
But the surprise was that he wasn't in a car and he wasn't electric.
What a swiz.
But I was not so much surprised that he didn't behave like a character on stage, but that because I knew that he had Asperger's syndrome and has had Asperger's syndrome and that obviously informs the music. And I kind of was expecting that kind of an effectless person, and he wasn't. He could joke about his music and himself and his family and stuff that he'd been through. The film, I was just totally endeared, as you say. I was just totally won over. I mean, his kids are adorable. His wife's hilarious. And for a long time, it was a kind of a bit of a cruel joke in music journalism, wasn't it? Gary Numan married a fan. Ha ha! How hilarious! You see this film, and it's just absolutely beautiful. She basically saves him.
She sorts him out. Totally.
She sorts him out and saves his bacon.
There's an amazing bit, and that's not mentioned in the film, funnily enough, that she actually wrote to Jim Will Fix It to ask if she could marry Gary Numan.
But I did like the bit where she talked about going to her...
So he's not all bad, was he?
He's not all bad.
I don't think he made it happen for her.
All right.
But there's the brilliant bit where she talks about going to her careers officer.
Yes.
And he asks her what she wants to do after school. And she goes, it doesn't matter because I'm going to marry Gary Newman.
I know.
And she gets sent out of the room.
Yeah. And she also... And they're all... Everybody in the film, you know, she and Gary Newman himself, they're completely open. And they tell stories that you kind of think would be too embarrassing to come out with, but because they're so honest, you're totally won over by them. She says, like, she used to fantasise that she'd be on her way home from school and Gary Newman would appear in his telecom outfit and save her from marauding Daleks.
And
I just thought, you know, if that's the way someone... If that's the way someone's mind works, then they fully deserve to get what they want, which is to marry Gary Newman. Good luck to her. What did you think, Dorian, of the film? Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, but I mainly liked it, you know, like, Johnny, for the other reasons, you know, not particularly the music. I mean, I like his music, but I didn't think... I think it's quite a boring idea for a documentary if it was just kind of like Gary Newman, unacknowledged pioneer of synth pop. It was more this sort of... I love these British pop stars who are quite sort of pooterish. And they've got very sort of humble, like Jeff Lynne is another one where you read interviews with him in the 70s and he just wants to have a beer and watch the football on the telly. And completely incapable of being a pop star. So you've got Gary Newman, millionaire at 21, buys a mansion. And there's this bit where he's describing how he bought a dinghy and he wanted to see what it looked like. So he blew it up in his front room. They couldn't be bothered to deflate it. So it never touched the water. And he just used it as a sofa.
Yeah.
And every night he'd just go home on his own and cook chips, because that was all he could cook.
Yes.
And sit on a dinghy.
In one room in this house,
in this
right?
In one room of the house.
He was scared of the rest of the house.
Which smelt of chips constantly.
He's a proper smash hits era 80s pop star.
Yeah. And it was just like, you're doing it wrong, Gary.
But it's like a fast show sketch, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, this is what somebody can't really do.
And he did
a pop
everything
star.
Wrong. He didn't mention this in the documentary, you know, but when he was just, you know, he said something nice about Margaret Thatcher, which was obviously verboten back then, and then got into planes. And again, totally on message, he just goes, I like them because they're machines and you control them and they're not like people.
Yeah.
They interviewed him 10 years or so ago, and that was when he was telling me about the Asperger's, literally going like, I know how to be interviewed, but if we were having a conversation, I would have to be cued to be interested in what you're saying. Which, I mean, a lot of people say that to me. But he had an actual particular medical reason for it. And he was very sort of frank about this. And so it meant that, you know, when he was being sort of thrown into this world of, you know, pop stars, he had no friends. I was like, who did you hang out with? Who did you like among your peers? And they go, nobody. He didn't know how to talk to them. So everyone just thought, oh, he's weird. They slightly resented him because he was really, he seems to come out of nowhere and become massively successful. You know, Bowie said something horrible about him, which just like hurt him for years.
Yeah.
And the terrible sort of loneliness, which of course feeds into the, you know, into the music. So you've got this quite sort of, you know, this really sort of heartbreaking backstory. Mm. And then even now that basically he's generally happy.
Yeah.
Although his version of happy is still a bit like, oh, I suppose I'm happy.
Yeah.
And then you'll be watching him, like, my favourite bits were, like, them bickering on the road trip.
Yes.
Or them arguing about whether serial killers just kill a lot of people or whether they torture them before killing them.
Can you have a good serial killer?
Yeah. And the good serial killers.
The nice ones. There aren't any nice ones.
And I just thought, yeah, watching them kind of bicker was sort of my favourite bit of the whole thing, rather than watching him kind of rock festival or whatever. Yeah,
but also he's moved to this amazing house in LA and he doesn't like it. It's creepy. There's suits of armour everywhere and he's like, I don't like it. I'm going to, he can't deal.
And
like,
all the rest of his family think it's the best place.
Yeah. His kids are running around.
His kids are fantastic. His kids are called Raven, Persia and Echo. And they're running around in like Princess Pink while he's in
good. They've each got their own mini Hummer by the looks of things.
They're obviously meant to be goths with names like that.
but they've gone Princess Pink like all little girls. And there's a brilliant bit where the interviewer says, what does your dad do? And one of them goes, he sings, he doesn't have a job, he doesn't go to buildings. And I just thought, I don't go to buildings by Gary Newman. We haven't totally seen that.
There's a bit in his dad says, I was surprised when he said he wanted to be a pop star. I can't leave anyone singularly unsuited. You know, does he do that? That's like, he's just not.
And it's absolutely right. But I think that's what makes him, and whether you like the music or not, and there are a lot of good Gary Newman records, and there's an awful lot that will only really be of interest to fans. But this is what makes him this singular and I think quite likeable figure. He is literally a great British eccentric. There is nobody like him.
But it's somebody who creates a persona.
Yeah.
And has to, because they feel that they themselves are so sort of boring and inadequate and parochial that they just have to, you know, and basically bankrupts himself with these amazing kind of presentations because he wants the fantasy of it. And I feel like...
Is it the lighting rig with like four artists to carry it?
He just kept just saying, stop spending money on the lights. He'd drop it a little bit, but still running out of money. And I feel like... When I saw Muse on tour this year, and I felt like actually that this kind of absurd, fantastical vision of rock music is sort of dying. There's not many people that want to be like, you know, Gary Newman or, you know, Roger Waters doing The Wall or one of those ridiculous concept albums by like Styx or Rush or whatever. And it's, I don't always like that stuff, but I love the impulse where you just look at yourself and go, I am not enough. So I'm going to create this magical world for my fans.
Yeah.
And it works. And you've got interviews with fans in there going, oh, it made it feel okay to be the weirdo growing up in, you know, Southern California. You know, it does. And Muse, that's why Muse are very internationally successful with a lot of different people, because they're like, oh, it's okay to be other.
Yeah.
In this, even if other people who aren't fans look at it and go, this is ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, this is essentially The Office featuring a musician, isn't it? It's his boring everyday life.
Yeah.
But it actually features a rock star. Is that the new model of rock documentaries? You just don't see tellies getting thrown out of windows and, you know, staggering groupies anymore. It's just, that seems to be entirely part of the past.
Yeah, well, maybe we have to, like Gary Newman, have to downsize our expectations, and that's what we get now.
It's about whether you want to let people in, and obviously he's got to this point and where he's just like... Well, why wouldn't I?
Yeah.
You know, and the problem is, of course, is that you're not getting, nobody's doing, you know, cocksucker blues with Beyonce.
Yeah.
Like, there's not that access. If you're a proper big star, you see their documentaries and they're so weirdly, they're self-produced.
Yeah.
And so sort of hauntingly artificial.
Yeah.
And so you need to be, I always think, the people you want to talk to are the people who have been humbled.
Yeah,
who have gone through this bad time and have, you know, rearranged their sense of how important they are or how they should be seen. And they just want to be like, which is like the state that Phil Collins is in now, where he basically just wants to be like, this is me. This is who I was all along.
Yeah.
I've been misunderstood. And at that point, people become fascinating. Whereas when they're still trying to say, no, I am this wonderful, untouchable celebrity super being. Of course they're not going to let cameras in and, you know, watch Beyonce and Jay-Z arguing on a bus.
Yeah.
You've taken the wrong... Yeah. Turning.
Well, you know, life at the top is fundamentally boring. It's on the way up and on the way down that where the interesting stuff happens. Well, Android in La La Land is in cinemas from August 26th. We recommend it to numanoids and non-numanoids alike. And we're coming to the end of the show, which means that it's time for closing time chatter. This is where we ask our guests for the story or the idea or the feature that's been obsessing them this week. Johnny, I believe you have a bit of a thing for a particular book.
Yes. So this is the new book by Simon Garfield, who is a non-fiction writer of 18 or 19 books. The one that sort of really that people really liked was his book about Radio 1, which he did at the point when smashy and nicey culture was kind of killed off by the new kind of arrival of Chris Evans and so forth. It was an oral history. And he's very good about tackling kind of huge subjects and making them very kind of pop culturally accessible. He's done a book about the colour mauve, for example, where that came from. He's done a book about the Mini. And his new book is called Timekeepers, subtitled How the World Became Obsessed with Time. And it's basically, his premise is that up until about 250 years ago, time was something that people kind of glanced at perhaps a couple of times a day to work out what they were up to. And now we obviously live our lives constantly in a state of panic about the time, checking the time on our watches and our clocks and computers and so forth. And he goes in at various different angles, kind of, it's not a history of time, it's a history of various things that have time as a kind of an important factor. Such as why the length of the CD is 74 minutes and not 60 minutes as it was intended to be, such as why Roger Bannister has run the 4-minute mile and is now has to relive those 4 minutes for the rest of his life because that's the only thing he's done and he's interested in. And it's like that, and it's just really fun and great, and he's a great writer.
Okay, and it's called Timekeepers. Is it out now? Available
it's
now?
It's out soon.
Okay, jolly good. Dorian, I believe you also have a book.
Yeah, it's by Brian Burrow, who's a Vanity Fair writer, and it's called Days of Rage. And it's about the sort of heyday, if heyday is the word, of radical left-wing terrorism in America, which was sort
great
of...
Great times.
69, well, you think, you know, the Weatherman is like the famous one, but they've also like the Black Liberation Army, the Family, obviously the Symbionese Liberation Army that kidnapped Patty Hearst. Mm-hmm. And it's just full of stuff that... It's got a lot of stuff that I already knew, and then all this stuff I had no idea, you know, like the, you know, the Puerto Rican independence fighters who were kind of blowing up restaurants in New York in the 70s, or the fact that actually the final, you know, these people weren't really apprehended until the early 80s.
Yeah.
The fact there was a plot to blow up the Statue of Liberty.
Isn't there a bit of a mad tale? I mean, obviously that is a mad tale, but...
I'm trying to write something about it.
Yeah.
Because... It was 1965, so it was like, wait, nobody was doing this stuff then, so it was very ahead.
They were really ahead of the curve.
They were really ahead of the curve. They weren't very good at it.
This is basically hipster terrorism, isn't it, Dorian? You're into terrorists that nobody's heard of.
It was like artisan. It was a startup, basically.
Yeah, pop up, blow up, pop up,
and it's just full of like stuff that you think should be really well known. That you think, why don't people remember the fact that there were these like assassinations of police officers in the early 70s? Yeah. Why don't people remember that this restaurant in Manhattan just blew up? Mm. Why don't people remember that Puerto Rican independence fighters entered the House of Representatives and shot congressmen in the 1950s?
Did they?
Yeah. And it was just a...
Bloody hell.
It was just like, there were things that I thought that you would just know.
Yes.
And that you don't know. And this book is full of stuff like that. And it's sort of exhaustively told, quite dramatic, novelistic recreations of some of the big incidents. But it just makes you realise that in general, you have a sense that you kind of should vaguely know the important bits of modern history. Mm-hmm. And of course you don't. And in any area, there's going to be tons of stuff that has just been forgotten despite being really significant at the time.
Uh-huh. Matt. I believe you.
Yeah, I would say because I was listening to De La Soul, and I went back and listened to 3 Feet High and Rising, and then I went on to listen to Paul's Boutique. I was wondering if Paul's Boutique was available on for download or through Amazon, and of course it is, and it was reissued only a few years ago in a kind of celebratory anniversary thing, which was you can talk about whether that's fair or not. But one of the things that I came across, and it's a few years old now, it's 3 years old, is a edition of Solid Steel's radio show, of Cold Cuts radio show, put together by three DJs, a tribute to Paul's Boutique, taking all the original samples and kind of knitting them together kind of in the right order, but extending some of them and reducing others and playing the instrumental breaks and using kind of bits of dialogue from a from the Paul's video of the Paul's Boutique launch party on the Capitol building, which is literally just like Sir Dennis Eaton's Hogs Tap into America speech from Wild on Tap. It's absolutely brilliant. And it is the chairman of Capitol Records kind of literally doing an Eaton Hog. And it's really interesting, and it's still available on their SoundCloud page, and you can download it.
Oh, amazing. Fantastic. Well, my closing time chatter is that I discovered a brilliant film in a way I didn't expect. The movie is called The Brand New Testament. It's a Belgian film. God lives in a manky apartment in the middle of Belgium, and his daughter, the daughter of God, escapes because she's sick of God messing the world around. I discovered this not through advertising, not through promotion, not through interviews, but through a Facebook post on the Mark Commode and the Five Live Film Review show. And it made me go and investigate this film in a way I would never have done if I'd just seen a poster or just heard an advert. And it made me think, why are movies not doing what music has been doing for years, which is trying to get you through the other route? Movies only go to you with a gigantic poster. Everything gets 5 stars. Everything gets a big quote from, you know, the Sunday Times or whatever. And it just writes white. It doesn't persuade you. You just look at it and go, yeah, that's a film poster. It passes you by. But if something pops up on a Facebook feed recommended by a human being, I'm interested, and I went and rented it immediately and thoroughly enjoyed it. So it just made me think if, you know, film marketing is going to go the way that music marketing has gone for a long time. But the film is called The Brand New Testament. It's really worth getting. It's on there. It's on iTunes. £4.50 to rent. So there we go. Another show done and dusted. Many thanks to our guests, Johnny Davis of Esquire magazine and Doreen Linsky of The Guardian and elsewhere. Remember, you can hear this show and our amazing back catalogue again on audioboo.com/channel/bigmouth. And if you want to subscribe via iTunes, just go to the podcast section of the iTunes Music Store, search for Big Mouth, and give us a star rating if you can, because, you know, it all helps fan the flames. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again next week for more top drawer pop culture natter. Bye-bye.